It's time for a more in-depth look at today's news. It's time to find out who's pulling the strings. It's time for the Behind the Curtain podcast with your host, author Jeff Reynolds.
Hello, and welcome to episode 14 of the Behind the Curtain podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Reynolds. This week's episode is one of my favorites, featuring two discussions that are fun, informative, and thought-provoking. It also features my first ever crossover episode featuring other podcasters in a joint effort. First, though, a note on my recording schedule. With the advent of summer and the kids out of school, I'm finding the demands on my time at an all-time high. I will continue to attempt a weekly show schedule, and starting this week, episodes will be released on Thursdays. So, this week's first guest is another blogger friend of mine. We go way back, so we have a lot to talk about. Kimberly Kay is the senior contributing editor of Legal Insurrection. We discuss the false racism charges that led to an $11 million fine against Oberlin College after a libel lawsuit, the newly formed Legal Insurrection Foundation to combat against the false information propagated by intersectionality and anti-Zionist activists, and what President Trump has done to turn her from an enthusiastic opponent in the primary to an enthusiastic supporter of his re-election. You can find Kimberly's work at legalinsurrection.com, and she's on Twitter at twitter.com/KimberlyKay. That's spelled KimberlyKaye. Kimberly also joined me for a bonus segment for our Patreon subscribers. This is exclusive content only available to the paid subscribers to Behind the Curtain on Patreon. In this bonus segment, we continued our great conversation by talking about Jussie Smollett, Justin Amash, and what Republicans do right on messaging, and what they do pathetically wrong. You can find it at patreon.com/BehindTheCurtain with Jeff Reynolds. My local guests this week are James Ball and Nick Prolosky. These guys are not only local Republican precinct committee people from Multnomah County, but they also host the Rational Republican podcast. They describe the podcast as promoting individual liberty and conservative principles while rejecting hatred and divisiveness. This episode was a cool concept where we began our discussion for a segment on their podcast, discussing our differences over the forced child vaccination bill that Oregon floated in this past legislative session, and ending with this segment on Behind the Curtain, talking about how Republicans can create messages that win hearts and minds in Oregon. We go in-depth on this topic and a few fireworks fly. Great discussion. You can find the Rational Republican podcast on all major podcast services and on social media by searching State Over Party. You can also check them out at their website, jamesaball.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Behind the Curtain podcast wherever you listen to it, and please leave a positive rating. The more subscribers and the better ratings, the higher Behind the Curtain will rank on podcast services like iTunes and Google Podcasts, among many others. Quick note about my book. I'm currently planning an East Coast trip in the fall to speak at my alma mater, Connecticut College, and their College Republican Club. I'm excited to return after many years and confront the liberal campus culture with real facts about who owns the professional left in America. If you know of any conservative clubs, Republican groups, Tea Party or 912 clubs, or anyone else who would get something out of following the dark money on the left, please email me at info@5440fight.com. Search for Behind the Curtain inside the network of progressive billionaires and their campaign to undermine democracy in stores or online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Simon & Schuster. It's available in hardback, Kindle, or Nook now. Check out whoownsthedems.com for more information. Welcome into the Behind the Curtain podcast. My name is Jeff Reynolds. I'm your host. And my guest this week is a longtime friend of mine that I met a long time ago through the blogging universe. And I'm tapping all of these relationships to make a better show than just having me on by myself. But today's guest is Kimberly Kay, who writes for Legal Insurrection. Kimberly, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. This is going to be a lot of fun. So I wanted to jump right into the issue of the day. I saw a tweet yesterday from Scott Adams where he tweeted out, "The time President Trump made the entire country debate whether Pelosi is a drunk, mentally diseased, or past her prime. Time invested, 30 seconds. And go."
It's true. And I think, I'm at the point with her and with many others where I'm almost feel bad for them. They bet the farm on Trump losing. He didn't lose. And now not only are they losing the farm, they're losing their shirts, they're losing everything.
And, you know, a lot of us on the right bet on Trump losing, too.
Yes. And it's, I mean, that's a completely separate discussion to watch how some people have adapted and others have sold out.
Right.
You know, I think many, myself included, have been able to read the tea leaves and say, hey, you know, I get it now, because I was staunchly anti-Trump. But once he was elected, I'm going, okay, well, he's our president now, for better or worse. And he has pleasantly surprised me throughout the duration of his presidency thus far. And after spending a lot of time talking to people who voted for him and supported him after the fact, which I suppose is something I should have given a bit more credence to ahead of the election, but lesson learned. I get it. I really do get it. You know,
and I don't necessarily think there was much of a strategy, but there was definitely something where he captured this anti-elitist attitude and really just understood it on an intuitive basis. And, you know, we all were concerned that he was flying by the seat of his pants during the campaign, but, it worked out, right?
Well, absolutely. And I think, you know, there's multiple layers here. I don't want to be too reductionist in discussing this, but there's multiple things happening all at the same time. I mean, we saw a huge shift in the GOP around 2008 with the when President Obama was elected, with the emergence of the Tea Party movement, right? Which started off as pure. It started off as a very genuine grassroots movement, was eventually taken over by hucksters and scammers and, you know, all that kind of thing, promising people mm-hmm. that they would oust then Speaker Boehner and, you know, impeach Eric Holder and just ridiculous things that no one would ever be able to do. But there was a rift in the Republican Party as far back as that, because you remember as well as I do, we were both there, especially for 2012.
Right.
When before you could even get a decent candidate. And there was a legitimate GOP establishment. You know, a lot of people like to scoff at that, but it is actually a thing that existed in a different
version. And it's still alive and well, by the way.
Yes, it is. It's alive and well. It's a little bit different version, because I think the entire lay of the land has changed since, you know, Trump came through and plowed through everything, which I actually love about him, you know.
Right. No, absolutely. That's one of the great things about him. Unfortunately, I think that the establishment is still in the same sort of stance that they're going to crush the grassroots, and they're going to depend on their focus group message and that kind of stuff. I see it at the local and the national level, at the congressional level specifically, and it's really unfortunate, because we can't actually take full advantage of this vast opportunity we've been afforded by the wrecking ball that is Trump.
No, I completely agree. And I'm nowhere near as involved in local level politics as I was in years past. Just because my focus has changed slightly, but
well, you have a family, so yeah, you know, that's a big deal.
Yeah. Babies getting married and having babies has a way of doing that.
Yeah, never mind a husband.
Yeah, right? Never mind the husband part, and you know, then we threw in a puppy on top of all of that, because of course, why not?
Yeah.
You know, it's just the amount of time that I have to actually engage in those kinds of battles that I used to engage in. Is a little bit different for now, but you know, that'll change too. But you know, right now my business is not just legal insurrection, but in taking care of my home and my family and all of that. Mm-hmm. But all of that to say, I do appreciate that he has come through and he's completely rattled everybody's cage on both sides of the aisle. It's not limited to the Republican side of the aisle, because I mean, we saw how many people, and of course I'm completely drawing a blank, how many long-term Republican congressmen just flat out retired rather than seek re-election, because they knew that this brave new world was not a place where they were welcome any longer.
And, well, Jeff Flake probably led that parade, right?
Yes, exactly. And so,
and Jeff Flake is the biggest disappointment on the planet because he was elected by the Tea Party, and he turned into an establishment swamp rat the second he got to D.C.
There were signs. There were signs. I remember, and for listeners who are not aware, Jeff and I both did work with Freedom Works years and years and years ago. And so at the rally that Freedom Works held specifically to help promote him in Arizona, Flake was very hesitant. He wouldn't meet with, I don't believe, if I remember correctly, that he would meet with the bloggers. He was very careful to distance himself from Freedom Works. So he was more than happy to take endorsements and money and support and grassroots organization, but really didn't want to get too close to anything that might sniff of Tea Party. And so that,
you know, and I wonder if that was I wonder if that was a backlash against the efforts that Freedom Works put in Utah a couple of years earlier to get Mike Lee elected over. And I forget who it was that he primaried, but a squishy rhino type of senator. I wonder if that was sort of a backlash.
It very well could have been. I mean, because you know as well as I do that no organization is 100% completely pure and right all of the time. You know, Freedom Works ended up doing what they did, and that's fine. No love lost. But I do think they did some legitimately good work there for a while.
Absolutely.
And so, and of course, that's where we met. That's where I was really able to immerse myself in the political world firsthand, because in addition to working with Freedom Works, I worked for their PAC. And so I would interview activists and candidates from all over the country and talk to them about, you know, the things that they were passionate about and the things that were really important to them politically. And it's just, it's so easy to forget that this country is huge. Even in Texas, we joke about Texas being five separate states, and it really is, right? You know, because regionally and culturally, accents are different, food is different. I mean,
it used to be its own country, right?
Yeah, it did. So we're all very us native Texans are very independent minded to begin with, but I mean, there's so many different cultures encapsulated, and that doesn't even include the fact that this is probably, if not the most diverse state. I know Houston's one of the most diverse cities in the world. It's never gets play for that, but it does.
Right. Well, it's in Texas, so you can't give them credit.
Right. Exactly. You know, and it's so seamlessly integrated. That's the thing. I remember. So when I moved to New York, I remember just being shocked at the segregation, the self-imposed segregation in New York.
Yeah. And here I lived in Boston, and it was the same way. You had neighborhoods where there was one race, and then a neighborhood where there was another race, and they never intermixed.
Right. And it is just not that way in Houston. I mean, you have some cultural pockets, right? But I mean, by and large, things are not completely segregated. There are socioeconomic issues, of course. I mean,
of course,
we can't move into a $5 million mansion. But like, it's just the way that said, I mean, there's just
Can't you turn in your privilege card and cash that in?
No, I wish I was issued one of those. I think it would really come in handy, as much as I'm told that I'm just so privileged, you know, by virtue of my skin color alone.
Yeah, your lack of melanin.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. So, but yes, I mean, all of that to say, I think it's just kind of to get, you know, back to what we were discussing. I do really appreciate the changes that he's brought. I do appreciate that especially when he engages the media. And so, and I understand all of the arguments about statesmanship, and I just, you know, I just can't buy into that, because what is statesmanship? You know, Andrew Jackson, like we had Andrew Jackson, we've had so many people, we've had, you know, look at what Bill Clinton did. Look at what John F. Kennedy did. Look at any number of these people in the life.
Look at what Ted Kennedy did when he was primarying Jimmy Carter, right? Yeah. He went to the USSR and met with the Soviets.
Exactly. You know, so you have all of these leading people who are in positions of high power, who are living in the White House, who have done really awful, terrible, unprofessional, unethical, immoral things. So statesmanship is really just an argument for sore losers at this point. It's just another, I mean, it's really.
And, and, And that's really what's wrong with the Never Trumpers, right? I mean, that's become as much of a cult as the Trump people were during the campaign.
So, you know, very disappointingly so. And I completely agree. And Justin Amash is I think a key example of that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about him.
And so, you know, because overt legal insurrection, which I have to toot our horn just briefly while I'm
here. Yeah, that's why you're here.
Yeah, so we're a fantastic blog. I'm the senior contributing editing there. I will have actually been there for 5 years in July.
Crazy.
Which is, yes, it is crazy, but it's also wonderful because we have an amazing staff of bloggers. I love that we are actually a blog. I think we, Professor Jacobson, who publishes the blog and who is my boss, is actually a clinical law professor at Cornell. And so, and he's been running Legal Insurrection for 10 years now. And we just recently, a couple months ago, launched the Legal Insurrection Foundation, which is something I'm really excited about. And the goal of that being that we're able to raise money to really dig deeper and investigate more into what is, the left refers to as intersectionality, right?
So this is sort of the ProPublica of the right.
Yes, yes. And I mean, we're focused on key areas specifically, you know, who's bankrolling the left, what's happening there, and then the whole issue of intersectionality too. I mean, it's the same people involved in that are involved in the anti-Israel BDS
Without movement. Question.
And so,
in fact, I wrote a book about that. I don't know if you heard.
Yeah, exactly, right? So it's something that you know well. So anyway,
yes.
But we're really excited about that. And we have a lot of really good things coming. Right now, we're the only outlet covering this, especially exclusively. We've had a reporter on the ground for several weeks. He is still there now. He's covering a trial. It's the Gibson's Bakery versus Oberlin College. So if you're not aware of this trial, it's actually kind of shaping up to be, and not shaping up to be, it has shaped up to be a fantastic referendum on social justice, or at least that's the hope in terms of outcome. So what happened, this was a couple years ago. Professor Jacobson began covering the trial, I believe in 2016, or not the trial, but the incident that eventually led to the trial in 2016. There were three African Americans that were busted for shoplifting. They later pled guilty for shoplifting. The bakery, which is a family-owned bakery that's been in the college town for 100 years-ish, was then accused of being racist, not just by students, but the bakery's alleging that administration officials engaged and encouraged this behavior. Pamphlets were handed out. I mean, it's just bad. And so, you know, all of this happens. And again, later these students that were accused of shoplifting pled guilty to shoplifting, and yet the racist mantra continues. And so rather than settle, they wanted to go to court. And so that's where it is, a very interesting trial. And we've been covering that on a daily basis. And so it's things like that that are actually very important cultural signals and really important battles where the little man is willing to stand up to the social justice mob. Those are things that definitely need a lot more sunshine and a lot more airtime. And so, you know, it's really our goal to make sure that they do get the time and attention that they deserve.
Yeah, you know, this is really interesting because it's so easy for those of us to look around at the landscape, especially folks that aren't as deeply invested like you and I are. You know, we're neck deep in all of this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And all the politics behind it. But it's so easy for the average American to look around the landscape and say, you know, I don't want to step on somebody's toes. I don't want to look like a racist. I'm not going to stand up against this stuff, when it's clearly wrong, when it's clearly anti-judicial, when it's clearly something that is designed not for justice. Social justice is not justice. It's designed to undermine the criminal justice system.
No, it's exactly what it is. And it's actually, you know, at its core is just furthering institutions of oppression.
And it's also clearly racist.
Yeah, exactly. And it's invalidating speech. It's making illegal things that should be free. And, but yeah, so this is, it's a very, if you pay attention to anything happening on college campuses, sometimes it can be absolutely terrifying. But I know that these things, I still believe, especially after 2016, even 2012, all the polling was wrong about 2012.
At least in the presidential election. Oh, yeah, it was awful.
And so yeah. I still believe, though, that there is a small minority that is a complete fringe that is so much louder than the rest of the people just going on about their business who don't think and believe these things. But
well, yeah, yeah, and you talk about it being coordinated, right? And it's all being driven by, and that's the book that I wrote. And I, now that you've given your plug, I have to give my plug. So it's called Behind the Curtain: Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy. And it's obvious when you look at, I mentioned earlier ProPublica, and I mentioned them for a reason. They're founded by Herb Sandler, who was referred to by our friend Phil Kirpin as the most evil billionaire in the world. And and so he founded ProPublica, I believe, in large measure to kind of clean up his reputation by investing in investigative journalism. But it's also something that's very slanted to the left. So I'm glad that you founded the foundation to kind of fight back against that stuff, because the more we normalize these fringe radical ideas, the less likely it is that we come back from the point of no return.
Right. I do think that there is a cultural shift. So I do think that we are experiencing a cultural shift that will ultimately kind of right the lurch leftward, because I don't believe that the majority of the people in this country buy into that philosophy. I think that the people who have this philosophy and who are buying into it are just very loud, and they have the benefit of the media. They have the benefit of Hollywood. They have all of these cultural institutions that they are making incremental gains, but I think they've pushed too far. I mean, we see that even in the abortion debate. And I wrote a post about this last week, I believe, about how Democrats only have themselves to blame for laws coming out of the state houses in, you know, Missouri and Alabama. Because when you have a governor, and this is not an obscure figure, when you have the governor of the state of Virginia justifying murdering a baby who was just born because they may have a deformity, I mean, and where does that go?
Or for any reason, really. I mean, what's the difference at this point?
You're still justifying killing a baby who was just born. Very shortly after that, there was polling conducted, and it showed that there was a huge swing, and that for the majority of respondents, the first time in years, more were identifying as pro-life. Most interesting part of that, when you looked at the crosstabs, though, is that this was not people who were of my parents' generation. These are people who are young Democrats who are going, all right, I think that might be a bridge too far even for me, right? And so...
Well, you know, and they always use Europe as an example to justify everything that they do. But if you look at the laws in European countries, most of them have restrictions on abortion past 20 weeks, 16 weeks, even 12 weeks.
Exactly. You know, and of course, as we're discussing this, I'm currently 13 weeks pregnant. I mean, so thought of any of this is just so beyond abhorrent, because with my first child, we had our first ultrasound at 6 weeks. At 6 weeks. Yep. I mean, there's no denying that what you see even then is a person, you know? And I think it's not just a cultural...
And they accuse us of being the party that denies science, but it's pretty obvious.
Science is catching up with this. It's one thing when you can convince women of these things before you can see them. But as the science and the technology continues to progress... It's going to be much more difficult to keep making the arguments convincingly that they've been making for the last 30, 40 years.
And that's why they fear the ultrasound laws so much.
They do. That's exactly why. You know, because you can tell someone it's just a clump of cells, but at 6 weeks when what you see on that monitor is definitely not just a clump of cells... I mean, good luck with that.
Oh, by the way, even if it is just a clump of cells at 1 week, 2 weeks, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, it's still the beginning of life.
Exactly. And so I think that they've definitely they definitely overplayed their hand there. And I think they're doing it in so many ways. And so, you know, I had fully expected that we would see what would amount to be some kind of party realignment, party restructuring, just based on studies and interviews and data that I had pilfered through that suggested that, you know, kids who are coming out of college and the younger generations identify not with political party, but with ideas, right? So what that means is that they're going to end up forcing some kind of shift in these labels and in that particular strata, in the political strata. I thought we might start seeing the beginnings of that in 2020, you know, 2024. I had no idea it would be so quickly in 2016. So,
well, it's the focus of the Democrats on all of their extreme crap that they're trying to push. They're not even trying to push through. They're not trying to get bills passed. They're just posturing, right? And they think that, that being as far left as possible differentiates them. Well, it does, but it also shows just how crazy they are and how little the average American actually agrees with them.
Absolutely. And I think that that's ultimately was Trump's appeal. And I had blogged about this, I think, before Trump had won the primary, that in many ways, so the Trump and the Bernie people were very similar. And in many cases, there was a crossover because both political parties had abandoned the center. And I'm not speaking just politically, you know, center, you know, the people who might care less about some of these issues than people who would identify as conservative or liberal versus, you know, just Republican or Democrat. But there is a whole world of people in the middle who are not necessarily politically engaged, who are not necessarily politically active, who have leanings one way or the other, who've been forgotten and completely forgotten and abandoned by both parties.
Well, you know, there's a great example of that going on right now in the state of Oregon, where I'm currently imprisoned, where we have this issue over forced vaccinations, mm-hmm. where, you know, we have this crisis of a measles outbreak, right? And, you know, 70-some kids got measles in Clark County. And so they're using that as a justification to expand the number of vaccinations that kids are required to have before they go to school. And they're also reducing the number of exemptions that you can be awarded, you know, religious exemptions, medical exemptions, those kinds of things. The bill was going, and it's going to come up again in the next session. Republicans temporarily killed it, but the bill was going to require that the Oregon Health Authority, not even a primary care physician, but the Oregon Health Authority, a bureaucracy of unelected bureaucrats, was going to decide whether or not you got an exemption. And so there's been this enormous backlash here in Oregon and in other places as well, where at the state level, they're trying to push these vaccine bills where, you know, it's so extreme that Gardasil, the HPV virus or a vaccine, is being required for elementary school kids to attend school. And, you know, you got to wonder why they care about an STD vaccine for grade school kids. But I've talked to a friend of mine who's a Republican candidate and also a neuroscientist, and she pointed out that the vaccine, the Gardasil vaccine, only guards against 4 out of 22 right. known strains of HPV. Right. You know, so but this is an issue that has people so fired up that we're getting calls at the Oregon Republican Party and all across the board saying that Democrats are switching their registration. I heard something like 80 new precinct committee people were signed up in the period of a couple of weeks in a rural county of Oregon, just because people were so mad and so fired up and wanted to do something about this, you know? So they're overreaching so much. There's so many of these issues that we don't consider in our retail politics, right? That we just go by the numbers and hope for the best, where we're not taking advantage on the right of these hot button issues that really affect people's lives.
No, I completely agree, because Republicans tend to be, Democrats are reactionary in one way, and that their response to everything is we must do something, right? But Republicans never look down the road and say, hey, these are the things that people actually care about. Maybe we should focus on this, and instead want to talk about boring things that no one cares about. And it's,
well, we're very risk averse, so right?
Risk averse, and to our detriment every single time. And I mean, it's one of the very, very first things you learn in political science 101 is that there's this concept of not in my backyard. And that's exactly what you see time and time and time again. People who are not necessarily politically active, but maybe Republican or Democrat because they grew up that way. They're, you know, aware, but they don't get involved, which means they're probably a lot saner than the rest of us.
And, without a doubt. You
know, but when stuff starts threatening their own families, you know, things that are happening in their immediate household, it really invigorates them, you know, to the point of getting involved and outraged. And that's how these things typically go. And we Republicans as a whole are absolutely awful at capitalizing on any of that. And I don't mean to say that politics is about capitalizing on the misfortune of others, but in some ways it is, you know, I mean,
well, I mean,
issues that need to be addressed. Right. And
You have to think strategically from a campaign standpoint, right? As how can we best capitalize on this thing that's going on in our culture?
Well, how do we address this? How do we respond to this? And one of the things that Republicans, and yet another thing that they've never, ever, ever done well, is to be remotely compassionate. You know, I know George Bush was was criticized for that to no end, but it's because he understood, I believe, that he's dealing with people, right? And, you know, liberals make a mistake to a different degree. Both sides make the same mistake. It's just calculated slightly differently, and that liberals bank fully on emotion, right? Without considering the fact that people...
Well, everybody votes by emotion, whether it's Republican or Democrat.
But it's not even at the voting box, right? I mean, you don't live your life purely based on emotional reactivity, because even the most emotionally reactive person is going to employ some logic at some point throughout their day, right? And on the opposite end of that spectrum would be what I believe, you know, for the most part, libertarians, but on the right side of the scale, who completely forego and forsake the human element and the emotional side in favor of logic and reason. Well, no one who is human, except for maybe a sociopath or something like that, is ever going to make decisions without
employing... Many of whom we know are in politics today, right?
without employing some kind of emotion. You know, so both sides make the same exact mistake. It's just, you know, on different ends of the spectrum. And, you know, there has to be a happy medium somewhere. I guess if there's an analogy, it's like being a parent. You know, if your kid's having a rough day, depending on what's going on with them, you don't necessarily lay down the hammer, you know, for no reason, right? There's a time for grace and there's a time for rules, you know, and there is a balance in between all of that. And it would be great if Republicans as a whole, or even just in messaging, for crying out loud, could figure out how to appear to be human and how to genuinely care about people. And I mean, I think just our system, that's one of the things, again, that I appreciate so much about Trump, or have come to appreciate about Trump, is that he's just turned everything up on end and is requiring people to make adjustments if they're going to survive. And,
you know, the best thing that Trump does, and my favorite thing about him, and I've still got my issues with him as well. And, you know, like Ben Shapiro says, there's good Trump and bad Trump. Most of it's good. Some of it's pretty bad. But, you know, the best thing that he does is he leads the media around by the nose just with his Twitter account. And he demonstrates what freaks they are. And they don't realize that they have no idea how to defeat him. And it's hysterical for me to watch. Just, you know, he allows them to demonstrate how out of touch
and
they are.
And I think
are.
That's you touched on something that I've talked about extensively too, which is another thing I absolutely love about this era, whatever we end up calling it, you know, assuming it's reported accurately and not revised into.
Well, it depends on who wins, exactly, right?
But it's just that even the AOCs, even Pelosi, who recently just completely lost her mind, and I don't say that lightly.
Recently?
I really watch myself with that because, you know, mental health is not a joke. It does get tossed around a lot, but it's not a joke. And my husband is a licensed therapist. I've moonlit in the mental health field. I mean, it's no different than joking about cancer, really, depending on the severity of symptoms. But anyway, so I just, I do really appreciate, though, that Trump being in office has allowed the crazy to just be put on full display, right? And so AOC and Pelosi and even all of the abortion arguments, you know, the truth will be made known. And they are at a point in all of their arguments where no one's pretending anymore. And no one is, they're not even trying to mask their real agenda. They're willing to come out and show their hand. And I think there's.
And they think this is going to win for them, and they're sadly mistaken.
Terrifying people. And that's why, you know, even going into 2020, I would caution anyone listening, especially, again, if you're not as deeply entrenched in this kind of stuff as we are, because it's what we do all day, every day, polling's not going to be indicative at all. I mean,
that's right.
Polling was wrong before because all wish casting. The same people conducting the polls are the same ones writing the headlines, or the polls are being sponsored by the people that write the headlines. So,
yeah, and polling is so dependent solely on name recognition anyway, and how familiar people are with the issues that are being presented. It has nothing to do with how they're going to pull the lever actually once they're in the booth.
And again,
right?
I mean, looking at 2016. And I think 2020 will be a bit of a different beast, but I think Trump will win handily because I think everything the Democrats are doing now is only going to make them look worse. You know,
I agree. I think he's going to win the popular vote, which makes that national popular vote compact thing even more hysterical.
Exactly, which is why, you know, they're freaking out. They know, they see the writing on the wall, and that's why they're going after the Electoral College. I mean, this is, as Professor Jacobson, my boss, has described over and over again, it is a soft coup. They're looking for every single way they can to delegitimize a system that has worked for us since our creation. Well,
that's just one aspect of the soft coup, but that's the whole point of my book, right?
And, at least since, you know, the Constitution was adapted, not the Articles of Confederation, but still, just for care. But you know, so I do appreciate that all of these things are being put on Front Street. And the crazy is walking around and they have normalized it. It is theirs to own. And the rest of real America is going, what is going on? No, thank you. And, you know, it's the same thing that's going to happen before, because in 2016, we had people who had never, I mean, they were in their 50s and 60s and had never voted in a presidential election in their entire life. Many of them had never even voted, who got out to vote for Trump. Right. And I read the headlines. I see what people are saying about Trump's popularity with women. And then I also see that it's women who are leading the donations for him this time around. So, the data is very different than the headlines. And that's one of the things, you know, we work every day to look at. You know, most of what I've spent the last 5 years doing is, well, actually, you know.
You're well, actually, guy.
That's not what happened. Well, actually, that's not what he said. You know, what he said was, or what the data says is, and what the numbers say are. So, you know, so there's that whole aspect to it too, because they want so badly. They still haven't accepted the fact that he won, even though here we are, you know, 2.5 years later. And they're definitely not.
Right. We're going into 2020 election and they're still talking impeachment.
Exactly. And they've done nothing. They've spent the last two and a half years trying to deal with the fact that he won to begin with. When they had they played this smarter, they would be using this opportunity to actually pass legislation and could pit Trump as an enemy of quote unquote progress that way when he keeps.
Right.
But the problem with Trump, I would say the problem, I think, for Democrats is that he's not unreasonable. I mean, the guy likes a good deal and he's willing to strike a bargain. And I actually really like that about him because polarization politically and otherwise is always problematic. And it's problematic because especially in a country as huge and diverse as the U.S. is, you know, the president is supposed to represent everybody. You know, he's not supposed to represent one particular keen set of interests, you know, and good leaders have a way of bringing people around to their side. You see that with Reagan, right? And there was a time when both sides of the aisle could actually work together. And the thing is, it's all theater anyway, because these guys all go to dinner together and church together and their kids go to school together. So everything we see about them, the warring and the hating one another, and of course there are conflicting personalities in there, but that's few and far between. It's all smoke and mirrors. None of it's real. Like, none of it's real.
Right. It's all a distraction from what's actually being done. Yeah. All right. Kimberly Kay, believe it or not, our first half hour is completely up. And I had all these questions I was going to ask you, and I got into question one, and we ended up here. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to save all these other questions about Jussie Smollett and Justin Amash and foster care in Alabama and the 2020 landscape and GOP strategy for our Patreon segment, which will follow here. So we'll wrap it up here for the free segment. And Kimberly Kay, one more time, tell people where they can find your work and how they can find you on social media.
Yeah, sure. So we're at legalinsurrection.com. My name is spelled kind of funny. It's all E's. So it's K-E-M-B-E-R-L-E-E. My mother did that. I do love it though. And then K, K-A-Y.
It is unique.
So Kimberly Kay. I'm on Twitter at Kimberly Kay and Legal Insurrection. I'm always there.
Outstanding. Thanks, Kimberly. I really appreciate you coming on. This was a true delight.
Likewise. Thank you.
If you like this podcast, the best way you can support it is by leaving a rating and subscribing. And don't forget to buy my book, Behind the Curtain, Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy. Also, stick around to the end of the podcast so you can listen to a full version of the song I Am America by my buddy Brian Futch, who graciously allowed me to use this as his theme song. Now it's on to the Oregon Story of the Week with James Ball and Nick Prolosky of the Rational Republican Podcast. Okay, welcome to the Oregon segment of the Behind the Curtain podcast with Jeff Reynolds. I'm your host, Jeff Reynolds, and I'm here with a couple of guests. We're actually recording live here at the Shiloh Inn on Airport Way, and I'm here with Nick Prolosky and James Ball of the Rational Republican podcast, and we just recorded a segment of their podcast, and we have a long discussion going on here, and I wanted to finish it up on our podcast, kind of do some cross-promotion, cross-pollination. So, James and Nick, thanks for being on the podcast with me. I really appreciate it.
Of course. You're very welcome.
All right.
To be here.
So we just got done talking a long discussion about HB 3063 and the forced vaccinations bill, and I highly recommend that you go check out that podcast. But I wanted to expand the discussion tonight about not just HB 63, but also the stuff that we're seeing in Salem right now, the overreach that's going on with the Democrats, some of the strategic stuff that we've talked about previously, and how we can take advantage of that as a party, as candidates, as people that are trying to get more candidates elected, Republican candidates elected in Salem, and kill this supermajority for good. So I wanted to ask you guys, first off, on this driver's cards for illegal aliens, this issue. This was something that came up on the ballot in 2014, and it was defeated, I think it was 71-39 statewide. It only won Multnomah County. It didn't even win Lane County or Marion County. Now we hear that it's probably going to pass in this year's legislature. So how is that going to affect the candidates that we recruit and what they message going into 2020?
I will answer that question by first introducing ourselves. James and I have started this podcast for the sole purpose of working to reach across the aisle and help get more Republicans elected, because we do believe that a solid conservative message can reach through to some small percentage of the of NAVs and of actual centrist Democratic voters, because far more often than not, we put forward great candidates, we put forward great policies, and a lot of times these people just don't vote for us because they see the R by the name and they're just tainted by whatever their perceptions are, and we're working to change those perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
So for your listeners, please tune into our podcast if you're not already. Come on.
Do it. It's do good. It. It's a good it's podcast. A good I've podcast. Listened to several episodes, and I'm not pissed off by most of them.
We have fun with it. We crack some jokes. We hopefully get some votes, whatever. I'm honestly the wrong Republican to ask on this issue, because I do believe that the benefits of some kind of identification for illegal aliens outweigh the costs. And I say that because I believe as a party, we are the party of immigrants. We are the party who should invite citizens from other countries to come here because it's awesome here. It's fabulous.
Well, that's why they keep coming, right?
Yeah. I were from another country, I would want to come here too, legally or illegally. And I think that Democrats here in Salem, well, not here, 30 miles down the road in Salem and in Washington, D.C., in the United States, make it far more difficult than is in any way necessary. There's far more cost. There's far more red tape than should need to be there for somebody to come to this country legally. And what happens when you do that is you incentivize people to come here illegally.
So when you go to other countries, what you can do is you can get an international driver's license that allows you to drive while you're there. I don't believe we're allowed to do that here. I didn't research this ahead of time. I apologize.
That normally sounds like a European thing. Like you're going to go across borders a lot more often, right?
Right. You take a test, you get an international driver's license allows you to drive. So one of the arguments for a driver's card for illegal immigrants is that now they can get insurance. Now they know all the laws, that it's safer, that there's some sort of, to Nick's point, there's some sort of, identification. This is very, fairly nuanced argument. So
James isn't big on nuance. we're just broad really stroking it over here.
Well, so, the reason I brought that up first was because it was very famously, you know, Ann Coulter wrote a column about it in 2014 after it was defeated. She said that, Measure 88. It was, the column was Measure 88 for President. Because it's something that almost everybody agreed on. It won by over 70%, you know? So, and if you guys want to, move on to different issues, that's fine too, because, there are a lot of them, you know?
I'm happy to talk about something that we've done. I'm a pro at that.
So my larger question, of course, being, you know, these issues that we have, like tolling, like gas tax, like the, all these things that appeal to folks all across the board. You know, we heard about that this evening listening to Senator Boquist. You know, there are a lot of issues where we're just not reaching out to the people that agree with us on the issues. So,
and I think that is what an election is. This was a quotation in a West Wing episode or a movie I've just seen or whatever. But it is an election is perceived to be a question of asking the, can you win a majority of the voters on any given question? When in reality, an election is you figuring out how to ask the right question. And if it's your question that gets asked, you win. If it's the other side's question that gets asked, you lose. If this is our question, if we make this our question, why are the D's in Salem trying to push through tolling on I-5 here in Portland? And 80% of Portlanders agree. Of Portlanders! Right. Just to stress that again, this is blue Multnomah County. This is D as D can get. If 80% of Portlanders agree that that's a bad thing, why are we not running on that issue?
Right. And I think we talked about this earlier, the issue of the vaccines is a similar issue. We've seen where there are a lot of folks, and this is anecdotal evidence, so it's not statistically significant, but we're seeing a lot of folks switch over. In fact, we had four ladies at the meeting this evening that one of them introduced herself to me after the meeting, and she's going to be on a future podcast. You know, this medical freedom issue issue has really fired up a lot of folks. So we need to be, as we talked about earlier, pro-science, but also pro-liberty, pro-personal liberty. So it's striking that balance, right? So we have to... I think we have to run candidates, obviously, Southern Oregon, Eastern Oregon, where those people will have a message for rural Oregonians. But in the metro areas where the elections are really decided, we need to have something that actually appeals to folks across the board. So
I think homelessness and mental health, I keep bringing this up on the podcast, is another issue that we can really message on, because mm-hmm. that is another thing that everyone sees. Everyone in the Portland metro area sees the homeless crisis. They see mental health. They see this addiction that is just this ongoing cycle. And the Democrats in power have not done anything about it.
Yeah.
So,
well, and Nick, you worked on Newt Bueller's campaign, and he actually tried to use that issue, didn't he?
He did.
And how did that go? Not to put you on the spot. I mean, we already know how it went. You know, yeah, right. spoiler alert.
Nobody tune into the end of this. And that's and I mean, you're absolutely right. I think that there is a, I don't want to say dangerousness is the wrong word, but I think there is an element of superficiality in looking at one aspect of what a candidate campaigned on and looking at the end result of the election and extrapolating the two and trying to correlate. Because there was some part of that. I think, frankly, a lot of factors went into Newt's loss.
And yeah, I'm not trying to pin it on one issue or the other. That's not the nature of my question. My question is, what did you guys see internally when he started using that issue? Was it effective? Could it have been more effective?
I think it was very effective. It was definitely a way to reach through to here in Portland, here in the Tri-County area, because it's a tangible thing. It's something that we see every single day driving around downtown, driving around some of the surface roads. There was a video that showed up 2 weeks ago on Oregonian. A guy took a bike lane on 205 North and he had to zigzag his bike through a bunch of different homeless camps. And it's like, this is again green hippie liberal bastion. We built right. these special bike lanes so people don't have to drive cars, and this guy gets accosted every 4 feet by a homeless person, and there's trash and there's drugs and everything right. like that. And so, yes, to your question, that resonated with a lot of people, that hit home with a lot of people. There's a lot of folks who are not necessarily as politically engaged as any of the three of us at this table are,
sure,
but because they see some of these problems. And now, could it have been more effective? Well, certainly, yeah, everything could have been more effective because A, the guy didn't win, and B, there's still a ton of homeless people and a ton of drug addicts who are roaming the streets of Portland, and they're not being served to the extent that they need to be served, either by going to jail because they're doing a bunch of illicit drugs, or by finding like a local church or something and getting help and getting food and getting shelter.
Yeah. So, a few weeks ago, I had on Angela Todd, who's an activist in, the Montevilla area of, Northeast and Southeast Portland, you know, 82nd Avenue mm-hmm. area where there's a lot of, you know, Montevilla Park has a ton of, permanent campers who are like, chopping down trees for firewood in the park, you know, that kind of mm-hmm. stuff. So, and she has gone out. She's created this Montevilla initiative where she's put together a coalition of just her neighbors, you know, just getting together and going out and actually talking to homeless people and, you know, hearing their stories and understanding what they need and understanding what's going on the streets. And, you know, she's had some hit pieces written against her by like the Los Angeles Times and stuff like that, where, you know, it's this vigilante group of, residents that's trying to create sweeps, which is not at all what she's trying to do. She's actually trying to talk to these people as individuals on a one-on-one basis. And I've always thought that that's something that we need to be doing more of. I'd like to be out there. I don't have time. But I'd like to be out there, you know, understanding what's going on there. And I think that's a fundamental kind of break between politicians and regular people. They don't go out there and actually talk to regular people outside of focus groups and photo ops and understand what their issues really are.
Well, and I'd frankly agree with that. I think that I've actually had that thought. I didn't know you were going to bring that up, but I've had that thought before. Is that be a fantastic white paper to go and read someday? Is what is it like to go and actually talk to a group of homeless people in, mm-hmm. in different neighborhoods here in Portland or in any, I mean, if you're working on behalf of another state in any city. But I think the causes of and factors that elongate a person's homelessness are myriad, and I think that'd be a wonderful thing to go and explore and try to craft public policy from that versus what a lot of legislators currently do and just kind of sit there and assume that they know what's best and try to figure it out based on a very limited set of knowledge.
One of the places I volunteer is I do safety at my church. Okay. So we meet at downtown Portland in the evening. And so basically kind of just watch people as they come in the door to make sure that they're not, you know, carrying weapons or going to be disruptive or whatever. And so I end up talking to a handful of homeless people through that. And I will say it is addiction and mental health or a combination of the two. Like that, at least the ones that come to our church and come in, it's, you end up talking to them and they'll talk and talk and talk and you don't even have to say anything. They'll just keep talking to you.
or talking to Harvey the rabbit.
Right. Or they talk to themselves it's very few of them that I've met do not struggle with one of those two things, addiction or mental health. And you can't just assume those people are going to go get jobs. You know, there has to be something, some mechanism whether that's public, private, or charities or churches or someone needs to help them because they are in such a place that they can't help themselves.
Yeah, no, and I think that there's a lot of finger pointing that goes on, right? And you know, I think you hear a lot of the, well, you know, all you want to do is sweep people and make them illegal and make them go elsewhere. And I don't think that's the solution. To a certain extent, that is the solution, right? We shouldn't be tolerating what goes on our streets, you know? But we bend over backwards to give them services. We bend over backwards to, allow them to use the ER for their medical needs and that kind of thing where we're not solving the underlying problem. We're not solving the mental health issues. And there are folks that need to be connected to services. And that's what one of the things Angela was talking about is a lot of folks don't know where to go to get those services. So there are ways that we could be reaching out, but the social workers in Portland and Multnomah County, it's actually Multnomah County that administers a lot of these things, and they just don't reach out to these people at all and wait for them to come into the office. And, you know, they're never going to do that. So, and there are people that need services that have no idea how to get them. So we could solve that problem fairly easily, I think, if we just reallocate our resources. But then there are the service resistant folks who are not going to respond to our overtures and do not want to not be homeless and do not want to change their lifestyle. And those folks need to be dealt with in a different way, a criminal justice way, probably.
Well, I think I've thought about this a while. But I think it's two-pronged. And to your point, you need to deal with both those people, the ones who want help and the ones who don't want help. Mm-hmm. And so how you do that is you reallocate your resources so that you have enough beds, enough counselors, enough whatever you need to service the people. And then you make it inconvenient to be on the streets.
Right.
People respond to stimulus. If you make getting help easy and staying on the street hard, people will get help.
Yes.
But you have to do those both at the same time. I feel like the ones on the left want to put all of their energy into these resources, but then you have people who don't want help.
Right.
And I think those on the right tend to try to criminalize the bad behavior without really providing the necessary assets so that those people can't have a place to go. I think if you can do a combination of the two, it's really the way that you help these people.
I agree with that 100%. And I think that's the way we ought to approach most of our public policy problems that we need to solve. And I don't think that we do that. We're too busy pointing fingers one party at the other, you know?
So, agreed.
Yeah.
We're pretty good at that.
Well, it's the environment these days, isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and that's an interesting question. In a Trump Republican party, how do we as Oregon Republicans, that's an interesting question. How do we differentiate ourselves? How do we take advantage of the opportunities and the environment we have? Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
Well, since you brought up Trump, I'm going to go back to the Newt Mueller conversation. My personal view on why he lost is because of Trump. I think that there were just a whole bunch of Democrats that came out to vote against Trump, and they voted, they just came out and voted D, and anybody who had an R next to him was on the chopping block. I think that's the primary reason that, that Buehler lost. I don't think it has anything to do with the stances he took. But to your point, I don't think there's anything we can do. The Republican Party is the party of Trump for the next 2 years, whether we like it or not, and
probably four
or six more years.
Yes, six more years.
And I don't think there's anything we can do about that. I think that in the Oregon Republican Party, Trump is a liability. Whether you agree with him or not, I believe that there are enough Democrats who hate Trump in this state. They're going to come out and vote.
Certainly in the metro area.
Certainly in the metro area. But there are a lot of people in the metro area.
Yes.
Which runs
the elections in this state.
Yeah. I think the next election is going to be another blue wave. And if Trump gets reelected, it's going to be four more years of Democrats in Oregon. And I don't think there's anything we can do about it.
So that is that's one point of view. James is a more glass half empty. I feel like I'm more of a glass half full. Although right now I just finished
you
my
just
beer.
Finished and yours
glass. Glass. Yeah, I'm glass no full, which is very unfortunate for everybody concerned. But I think that James, I think that you are right. I think that Donald Trump cost Newt Buehler the election. I think that if we had President Hillary Clinton right now, we'd have Governor Newt Buehler right now. We're never going to know a contrapositive. There's no way to go back and prove that. But I agree with you. I think that that's the case. I think that Donald Trump does not have to be a liability because I think that there are a number of good things that he has done as president and as a Republican that are very easily to point to. And a lot of times you hear people do interviews on the radio, you just read in the news or whatever, and people just say, well, what, you're a Trump supporter, why do you like Donald Trump? People just go back and say, well, he tells it like it is, or he delivers on his promises. They just say these very ethereal 30,000 foot view. And it's like, no, that's don't point to ephemera. Don't point to stuff like that.
Certainly don't bring up his personality. That's not going to play an
argument,
right?
Yeah. Well, if you would have said to a Republican 5 years ago, hey, we're about to elect a Republican. Hey, that's great to the presidency, but he's an adulterer. He swears. He's clearly not religious. Like all of these things, that Republican would have laughed in your face because it's like, no, there's no way we're ever going to elect somebody like that as representative of the GOP. I think it is incumbent on us as members of the Republican Party, if you're pro-Trump or anti-Trump, to say, yes, there's good things that he has done as president. Here they are, A, B, and C, and point to the policies that you like. There are bad things that he's done, and there are costs to having him as president, and they are this, A, B, and C. And I think for us here in Oregon, he is not perceived as being a pro-environment type of person. He's not perceived as being a pro-LGBTQ person. He's not.
Even though he's actually done some pretty good things for the LGBT community.
He actually has. And I think that is very significant. And that just gets ran roughshod over.
Yeah.
People don't pay attention to that at all because
he's a caricature of what they already believe about Republicans, right?
Well, exactly. Yeah, because none of us, none of the three of us at this table or members of the GOP in general can get up and say, no, he's actually very pro your cause. He is very pro same-sex marriage, same-sex couples, whatever
family
it is.
Leave,
a lot of these different types of things.
Yeah.
And I think it's worth it for us to say there are good elements to this presidency. And yes, there are things that he does nationally that are not right for Oregon. And here's how we could change that. And I think having that conversation, having that, let's take a look, 20-30% could be different. Let's have that conversation. You could do that, not lose the people on the right. You could bring over some of the people on the left and just say, look, Donald Trump isn't on the ballot in Oregon in 2022. Why don't we have a conversation about what's right for Oregon? Here's what I think it is.
And that's really the key, right? When we've been successful in the past, Oregon Republicans have said, the national scene is one thing, but here are the issues that are actually affecting us here right now, like tolling, like taxes, like this cap and trade bill that's going to increase everybody's cost of living by 4% every year. That kind of stuff, the gas tax, it's going to go up anywhere from 17 cents to $2.85, depending on how this HB 2020 goes, that kind of thing, So there are a lot of opportunities there. And I think, yes, to James's point, he's probably a liability, from a, macro view. But if you drill down into the facts and it always comes back to the issues that affect the voter, right? I mean, all politics is local.
Well, they say that.
I mean, let's be honest, okay? All of the Democrats in Oregon are going to be running against Donald Trump in 2020, and they're going to go further to the left because they're not going to get all their legislative agenda accomplished in this session or the short session next year. So they're going to go even further to the left and further anti-Trump. So that actually presents us an opportunity to come in and fill in the middle and say we're the reasonable ones. Rational, maybe.
I was going to say.
The Rational Republican. Go ahead and plug your...
We got to get that in. We got to be Rational Republicans.
That's right.
Yeah, tune in. Exactly. JamesAball.com.
There you go.
No, I think that you're exactly right. I think that there is such a tribalism anymore that is created by Donald Trump.
Yes.
That is, I think, an objective bad. If you're pro-Trump or if you're anti-Trump, just... people's reflexive reactions to immediately not in any way consider what the policies are or what bills are being put forward, but just here's this guy and I like him because he tells it like it is, or I don't like him because
he tells it the way he tells it.
I was going to say grabs women. I don't know if you can swear on your podcast, that's like, there's a lot of things.
Go look it up. Yeah, Donald Trump grabs him by the.
Yeah, right.
I think it'll fill it in for you.
I doubt that there's any listener to this podcast that has no idea what you're talking
don't
about.
Don't know how to complete that quotation. But I think that you are exactly right. It is incumbent on us to move away from the personality and move toward the policy, because we win on policy. Conservatives win on policy, on taxes, on homelessness, on LGBTQ, on the environment. We are the moderate, rational, reasonable voice that can implement good, positive changes in Oregon, in a state that I've only been here for 4 years, but in a state that so desperately needs change.
Oh my goodness.
And there is a vacuum in the middle. There's a group of people that we can win them.
Yeah, I think we can. I want to go back, and I don't want to turn this into, you know, kick Newt while he's down kind of thing, because, that's not the point of my question or my observation. But I do want to say that I think it was a tactical error that he went so far to make the point, I'm a pro-choice Republican, I'm pro-LGBT, you know, he tried to retake those issues from the Democrats, or to neutralize those messages that the Democrats were saying about him. And what did the Democrats do? They said, well, he's mini Donald Trump anyway. So it was completely ineffective, but also he seeded those arguments. He did not create his own arguments. And I think that's been a problem that the Republicans have not, that's plagued the Republicans in Oregon for decades now, that we allow the Democrats to frame the argument and frame the issues, and we play on their turf. We never set up our own issues. And when we do, we win. And Measure 88, the driver's cards issue from 2014, is a clear indication of that.
So I've actually looked at the election data from the Buehler race, and not to contradict your point, but... Well,
but to contradict your point.
But to contradict a little bit.
This is where we disagree. We agreed on the other podcast.
Right. Well... So looking at the way that people turned out to vote, and a lot of the arguments is that because Buehler did some of the things he did, went left on some issues, that the far right Republicans were not going to vote for him. Well, the fact of the matter is Republicans turned out in greater numbers than they did 4 years earlier. So whether or not they voted for him is another question. You can't really tell that from the data, but they did turn out.
Yeah.
And so one would assume that the majority of them then voted.
We can assume not a lot of Republicans voted for Kate Brown. I would like to think.
I would hope so, yeah.
Right. And the third party candidates didn't get a lot of votes. So they didn't go third party.
But that's not actually my point. I agree with you. I think that most Republicans, more Republicans turned out than normal, and they voted for Newt. And, mm-hmm. and he didn't lose them with the run to the center, run to the left messaging strategy that he had. What he failed to do was pick up the people in the middle and the Democrats that he was targeting. That was clearly his strategy. And I think that failed. Okay. And that's why he lost.
Certainly didn't work well enough, even if it...
Well, yeah, I mean...
Fair enough. Debate the level of effectiveness.
And objectively, he failed. He lost by 6.2 points, and that's... And I think that is not a reflection on the strategy as a whole, nor, frankly, for to reflect what conservatism as a whole. I think Newt is more representative of what a conservative is than somebody like Donald Trump. Topic for a different podcast. We could get into that at some point.
I agree with you, by the way.
It's a whole ball of wax. But I think that you are exactly right in that there's a quotation from Mark Twain. If you get a reputation as an early riser, you can sleep till noon. We in the Republican Party have a reputation as early risers, but instead of that, we have a reputation as being anti this, that, and the other thing. And there needs to be more people like Newt Bueller who get out there and who put that message out there from a conservative point of view.
Right.
Because this, and again, this is anecdotal. I'm not a pollster. I haven't looked at polling data, but I've talked to a lot of different friends that I've got who are here in the Tri-County area who have said, I like Newt Bueller. I like his policies. I like what he stands for. And I don't think Oregon is going in the right direction right now, but I voted for Kate Brown anyway. And I said, well, what are you doing? Why would you do that? And they said, because I just don't trust that he's a Republican. He brings with him that reputation, that anchor, that albatross around his neck of he is just anti all of this, that, and the other thing. And even though he was making the arguments that he needs to make to win over those moderate and center left voters,
they just didn't trust him on being authentic on that attempt, right?
Well, or not necessarily authentic even, but to be the one person among the many Republicans who was like, maybe he actually is telling the truth on this. Like, I think he's just trying to win my vote.
Well, I've seen this a lot online too, is anybody who sees an R by your name, they feel you're guilty by association. Mm-hmm. They say the Republican Party is anti-gay, it's anti-immigrant, it's anti-LGBT, you know, anti-everything, fill in the blank. If you are an R, you associate with those people. You choose to associate with those people. Therefore, you are guilty by association and never vote for you. And I tried discussing it with these people, and which is never a good idea online. But that's the argument that kept coming up.
Some of those
people
might listen to this podcast.
I was like, this was on Reddit, so I don't have any idea who they were. But just that argument kept coming up of, you are a member of this party. You chose to be a member of this party. This party stands for X, Y, and Z. Therefore, you stand for these things, and you cannot convince them otherwise. And it's, I don't know. I don't know what to do about that. I guess just kind of accept that they're going to be Democrats forever. And
yeah, well, you're talking to the hardcore, right? I mean, you're talking to the people just by the nature of their responses to you, they sound like people that are activists and involved, and they're on Reddit to go slay trolls like James Ball, you know?
So massive.
I don't use my real name online, so yeah, nobody has an idea who I am.
CrossFit 1986. Go find
him. You do CrossFit?
I do. Did I not mention that already?
I should have. I thought that was the name of your podcast.
I don't even know if you're actually born in 1986. I'm just
85. You're off by a year.
Wow, there you go.
I graduated eighth grade in 1985.
Yeah, there you go.
Anyway, so I think that you're talking to folks who, and I think there is I think what you're doing is talking to folks who are obviously never going to be convinced, and they're just out there to do the sparring. I think there's some value in doing that sparring, by the way, because you're out there demonstrating that there's a rational opposition to what this leftist is saying. So sometimes, not often, but sometimes when you engage in that stuff online, it actually gets people to engage with your ideas who are sitting on the sidelines and not participating in the argument.
Right. The person I'm talking to may never come around, but there might be somebody reading that discussion who says, hey, wait a second. Not everybody stands for these things that I have in my mind of what the Republican Party is.
Right, right. And hey, by the way, even if I'm pro-life, I'm still pro-personal liberty, and I'm pro all of the good stuff in our platform that most people actually agree with if they don't know it comes from the Republican Party platform, you know? So just because I'm pro-life doesn't mean I'm anti-woman or anti-women's healthcare or that kind of stuff. It's just being framed that way by far-left activists, you know? So
it's the vernacular you choose. It's the wording you choose. And that's, I love the show The West Wing, and there's a podcast, The West Wing Weekly, that I listen to. They had an episode today where they brought in a religious person for reproductive rights. And it's like, You can be pro-life and pro-reproductive rights. Nobody's saying you can't reproduce. There's,
reproductive rights are very pro of that.
Yeah. Like, yeah. But I think we as a party are, we get mired down. And I, frankly, I think the left does this too. That, you know, there's these, like somebody like Barack Obama, somebody like Ronald Reagan that puts this transformative, happy collective vision of we can all get along because we have one great communicative unified leader. And that's exactly not what an election is. An election is 50% plus one. And if that's you convincing somebody who's further to the left, who's never voted for Republican, that's great. If that's you digging up, you lose by one vote, or you go find two new people who have never voted and they vote for your cause, that's great. Like, a win is a win. And we as conservatives in Oregon need to focus on winning, because that's how we implement public policy. And I think that's you have said earlier, I honestly, at this point, I forget if it was when you were recording here for this podcast or if when we recorded for our podcast, that you are a constitutionalist first, a Tea Party member second, and a Republican third. I'm a victor first and a Republican second.
Yeah.
I want to win. I want to put a message out there that wins, and I want to elect the candidates who can implement that and take that message and turn it into public policy. And that's why we started the podcast that we do. And I think that that is the thing, that there's a lot of people who are out on the right. There's a lot of people on the left too, but I'm frankly not worried about them, because if they lose elections, I'm happy. But there's a lot of people on the right who are willing to say something that is not in the best interest of winning an election. It's they're trying to most clearly advocate their principled stance on something. They're trying to most clearly advocate their, what, you know, what they've read or what they believe or whatever. And that's fine. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I'm saying there's a way to frame that argument in such a way that you can make it about electability. You can bring new people.
Well, it's
got
to be done strategically, right?
And that's exactly
so many folks only get fired up about the issue that they really care about, and they're not like us. They're not political nerds. They're not thinking, how do I turn this into a strategy for victory?
It's interesting, because politics is comprised of so many different groups of people. Obviously, from issues, there's a lot of different issues being represented. But from just a strategy standpoint, there's diehard philosophical people. Mm-hmm. There's people who focus on the election first and foremost. And maybe the candidate is only the guy that you agree with 51% of the time, but he's still better than the 49% of the time guy. So that's the guy that you're working for. And you win or you lose if he wins or he loses. And we are the big tent party, and it's incumbent on us to find a way to bring people together. And I think one of the great ways to do that is podcasting.
I agree. Go ahead, James.
Yeah. What I was going to say earlier that I forgot. If you don't win elections, nobody cares what you think. You can have these very strong opinions about very certain things, but if you can't win elections, it doesn't matter. Like, you don't have any influence. You don't have any voice. And so, to your point, that if you agree with someone 51% of the time, vote for that person rather than the 49. But if you abstain, or if you vote third party, or if you do something else, and honestly, that's why I'm a Republican. I don't agree with 100% of the things in the Republican Party platform, but I agree with more of them than I do the Democrats. So this is the party that I choose to affiliate with and be a part of and be involved in.
Aha! I just found something we disagree on. So I think if you look back at the history of William F. Buckley and Barry Goldwater, they both ran races that they weren't necessarily going to win. And they did it anyway to articulate the conservative standpoint, the conservative view. You look at Bill Buckley said not to nominate the most electable candidate. What he said is you nominate the rightward most viable candidate, which is completely different than nominating the most electable candidate. You want a candidate who can be viable and who can carry your message forward and articulate that in a way that changes hearts and minds. You play the long game. So even if you lose that election, Barry Goldwater lost 1964 and is credited widely with tilling the ground for Ronald Reagan in 1980. So, it's an interesting, you have to play both. I think my thought is you have to do both. You have to do the short game and the long game, but the long game you have to do. I've talked to people who wanted to run against Earl Blumenauer knowing that you're cannon fodder. Mm-hmm. But just to get the ideas out there that, hey, look, you know, this guy's kind of nuts and there are better ideas than just that.
And there is a place for quixotry and there's a place for candidates who are, and that's like call a spade, that's what it is.
Sure.
There's a place for candidates to get their ideas out there. And yeah, maybe the best guy to run for CD3 is, for lack of a better word, a wingnut. But if he gets ideas out there, he knows he's not going to win. Maybe he knows, like, maybe that's not somebody that I'd agree with for a ton of different issues. But there's a place for candidates like that who can raise the level of discussion and just not let one party, which here in Oregon is often the Democrats, just steamroll over things and just assume that everybody agrees with him. That's another line from The West Wing. There's a story about the guys running a race and there's a wingnut Republican who runs against him. And finally, the guy says, what are you doing here? This is the Bronx. This is Democratic territory. You're going to get maybe your own and your mother's vote. Why would you do this?
Probably not mom's.
Maybe not. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the candidate in this story on The West Wing, the candidate says, this is my district and nobody runs in my district without talking about my issues. And there's no reason that we can't have somebody like that here in Portland to run against Earl Blumenauer, knowing full well you're not going to win that race. But that tills the ground for a number of other conservatives.
Maybe
if you
get
the message out there.
Maybe that softens up a legislative district that's a swing district, like 51 or something like that.
There you go. Yeah.
So, paging, just a thought.
All right.
I mean, you know, there are. I think we have to think a lot bigger as Republicans in Oregon. We have to think a lot more strategically, and we have to be a lot more organized. And we just don't think like the Democrats do, and it that's how they're beating our brains in.
They are fair. Professionals at that, and we got the results to prove it here in Oregon. It's not great.
Yep. All right. Well, I think that's a great place to stop. James Ball and Nick Perlosky, thanks again for joining me on the Behind the Curtain podcast. Real quick, one more time, give a plug for your podcast.
Sure. We host the Rational Republican podcast. You can find us at jamesaball.com or by searching the Rational Republican on any podcasting service.
All right.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yes, thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
This was a lot of fun, and we had some scheduling issues, and so I'm glad we were able to get this done. It's now about 10:30, and we're all
Shiloh
falling asleep here,
Wednesday.
But I appreciate you guys sticking around for me.
Absolutely.
All right, thanks, guys.
Thanks for checking out the Behind the Curtain podcast. I want to thank my buddy Brian Futch for providing me the theme song, I Am America, produced by Cass Anawati. Join us next Wednesday for another episode of Behind the Curtain with Jeff Reynolds.
Great-grandpa sailed here from across the ocean. With nothing else but his dream for a better life. Over there shook their heads at such a crazy notion. But deep down in his heart, he knew he was right. He cleared the way for you and me. You can still hear his spirit sing. I am a man. There's no price for his country he wouldn't pay.
the cause with great devotion. Just like his daddy, he led the way. Yeah, yeah, yeah. His stories have faded with his years, but his eyes say it loud and clear. Carry this dream along, and that's what makes